You're just in time for Ham Nation, and we've got a great show for you tonight. Bob talks AM Window, Gordo talks noise, Randy takes us to a really cool museum. We've got the Newsline report, Dr. T has sun stuff, and Amanda has chat room questions, and of course, we've got you. And that's the best part. So stick around. Here comes Ham Nation.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
This episode of Ham Nation is brought to you by LDG Electronics. LDG Electronics provides state-of-the-art automatic antenna tuners and related products for every amateur need. Visit LDG Electronics to learn more. By ICOM. For more information, visit icomamerica.com/hamnation. And by DX Engineering. DX Engineering offers practically everything you need to outfit your shack, plus the fastest shipping in the industry. Most in-stock items ship the same day, Monday through Friday until 10 p.m. Eastern. For more information, visit dxengineering.com/hamnation.
This is Ham Nation, episode number 420 for September 18th, 2019. Randy visits the Early Television Museum.
Hello, everybody. It's Bob Heil, K9EID, and we welcome you to Ham Nation. And it's a show all about ham radio and other crazy things that hams do. And I really appreciate you being here. A very special night, and we'll have a lot of fun doing it. First of all, let's find out who all is here. I think Don Wilbanks is here from down in the New Orleans area, lower Mississippi. How you doing, Don? You okay?
I am. I'm doing great. Getting ready to leave Friday morning for Peoria, Illinois for the Peoria Superfest. Young Ham of the Year will be there. Drew Vreba, also Joe Eisenberg will be there. Paul Brown, one of the Newsline people, will be there as well. And hope to see you there, too. I'm speaking at 10:30 Saturday morning, and hope to have a good crowd to talk about Newsline and Ham Nation and Young Ham of the Year and anything else that that we can think of. Oh, hello to all of our WTWW listeners. Go online at WTWW.us, click that request tab, and get your song on the air. It's an amazing technology that they're doing that. You'll hear it almost immediately. It's just, it's so much fun. WTWW.us. And we're proud to have them as one of our partners here on Ham Nation. They do great things for us, and we do appreciate them. Another one we appreciate a lot is Dr. T. We'll have information from her coming up a little bit later on with Amateur Radio Newsline and a whole lot more. Bob, it's going to be a good show.
All right. Well, we're looking forward to all of that as usual. You'll have fun in Peoria, that's for sure. And George is here. George, how are you doing?
I'm doing fine, Bob, and it is just way too hot down here to be approaching the end of September. Wow, it has, I don't know, it has felt like 100, it seems like, forever now. Hasn't been there, but it's been just right up 100. But other than that, hey, everything's going good. I'm going to visit some transmitters probably tomorrow. And I've got a video tonight. This is, it's just a portion of a video that Randy shot here a while back during his travels. We can't show the whole thing tonight, but we've got a little piece of it that you're going to want to see. And after you've seen that, you'll want to go watch the rest of it over at Randy's YouTube channel.
It is amazing. I watched some of it today. Early television from way back. I think it goes back into the 20s or 30s. You're going to enjoy this, everybody. So pay attention when that fires up. And what do we have from Southern California? It's Gordon West. How you doing, Goro? What's up?
Oh, we're just fine, Bob. Good to see you and all of the Ham Nation hosts. And a note from Bill, WZ1 Lima, saying this past weekend's Boxborough Ham Fest graduated about a dozen brand new hams, and Boxborough was a huge success, for the ARRL New England Convention. And coming up, let's see, shortly, Spokane is going to have a ham fest on Saturday, September 28th. That's a great one in Spokane, Washington. Also, the Wind System Campout. Many of you have tuned in to the Wind System all over the country, actually all over the world. The Wind System Campout in Pechanga, local down here, RV resort, and we'll be there for that one. And finally, a note from one of our advertisers, LDG Electronics. They teamed up with Handy Hams, and $2,500 later, that went to Handy Hams. LDG awarded a TW1 talking watt meter. And for those Handy Hams without vision, the talking watt meter is going to be a welcome addition to their station. Back to you, Bob.
All right. Yeah, the Handy Hams do some wonderful things. And hopefully one of these days we need to get some of those guys and gals on here. Well, I have some things I want to bring to you. But before we start, I have a piece of sad news about one of our great fans and just a stalwart in the chat room, and that's Jim Scheidler, W5JCS. And there he is with his brother, who is his Elmer, and he lost his brother this past week. And I really, really feel sorry for you, Jim. He's one of my great fans. Whenever I do organ concerts, he even brings his mother and sister, and they're just at every ham fest we see them. And Jim, just hang in there, buddy. You'll be in our prayers, that's for sure. He's in the chat room, I think, tonight. So his brother had been his Elmer. How cool is that? So hang in there, buddy, and we're all here for you, and hopefully you'll be able to work through this. I appreciate the pictures, Vic, very much. Well, this was the Route 66 week, this past week, and we don't have all the full numbers, but I'll get them for you. Maybe next week we'll have them all, but you know, here in the Springfield area did so well. There are well over 3,000 contacts, and That's really a wonderful, because it's kind of the first year that the club, the Southwest Missouri Amateur Radio Club, SMARC, took part in a big way. And we're really proud of them. They did well. I was not able to be there. I've been back in Illinois. I just got in here right before the show into Pleasant Hope, but they did a wonderful job, and I applaud them. So we'll have you some further numbers next week. What I want to talk about, but maybe before I do that, I came across something in the archives at the Heil plant the other day, and I'd forgotten about this. Oh, I remember it well. This microphone was used by Elvis Presley. He came to St. Louis, and his management called me on the phone at Ye Olde Music Shop in those days. We were just starting to into the sound business. This is the late 60s and early 70s. And asked me if I had an SM50, 53 or an SM54. That they had checked the records, and I carried all kinds of special things. That's what made Ye Olde Music so popular. And so they came and got four of them. I rented them, two of them, but they bought three of them. I got one back. And I never thought much about it. I have so many things. The microphone I'm talking at, it's a Carrie Underwood microphone. Let me do something. This could be dangerous. Hang on. See if it still works. And I haven't touched any of the EQ. As you'll notice, a big difference, of course. The patterns are all crazy, but that's what we had in the 70s, and that was top drawer back then. Oh, let me get back here. So for all the Elvis Presley fans, you can go find pictures with him with that microphone, I can tell you that. Just fun stuff. Well, here's some fun stuff, but we have to start paying attention to this one. And I've talked about it before, but we're really on a real vendetta here to try to get this across to as many as possible. And we're talking about the windows. We have AM operation. We have sideband operation. We have slow scan TV. We have CW. We have the DX window. And some of the guys and gals that come into the hobby in the last decade or two are not aware of that because the windows are not talked about much, and they should be. And we're trying to make people aware of this, and I'm very excited that the board of directors of the ARRL have finally kind of woken up to the fact that there's a lot of newcomers that don't know about these windows. So you get guys taking their sideband VFO and just sliding it wherever. AM operation is with a lot of vintage gear, and they're crystal controlled. And what we're talking about is things that look like this. Here's a crystal for 3880. I remember when we built the pine board, that's what sets the frequency. We didn't build a VFO. We used crystals. So they can't move around much, especially big broadcast transmitters. George can verify this. Once you set a broadcast transmitter on a frequency, you can't vary it, maybe 20 KC if you're lucky. So they're pretty much fixed, and that's why we have the windows. So the AM guys and gals can be in that 3870 to 3890. Vic, I think I sent you a chart. If you could bring that up, I'll give you a little bit of idea of what we're doing. And hopefully this thing will get expanded again as it did when it happened back in the late 50s, early 60s. I was there when all of that went down. And I can tell you, they had wars. I mean, people came to people's houses with shotguns. It was terrible. Nobody got hurt, but you got to get your sideband off of my frequency. You got to get your AM off of my side. It was awful. They were not gentlemen. But finally, somebody got a hold of it, and this is what happened. Kind of set that up on their own. And it's been that way for a long time, but the last 30 years, it's just kind of been put away. Well, we got to bring it back. And you know why? Because the new transceivers, the 7300, the 7610, all of those new transceivers, they are beautiful sounding on AM. And up until then, some of the transmitters didn't sound very good on AM, so a lot of people didn't go there. Now, you can be real proud to move your VFO into one of those windows, and you'll be there. So I wanted to make you aware of this, make a copy of that, do a screenshot, and just make sure that you keep your single sideband outside of that, and you keep your AM there. Now, that's not to say you can't move around as long as there's not somebody beside you, but this is kind of a beginning start of what you want to do when you start working AM. I just thought we better talk about that and let everybody know and pass it on to your clubs and all of those things. So that being said, we're going to move on. And I think Don has a word about a really hot tuner, LDG. That's correct, isn't it, Don?
Yes, it is. LDG is good stuff. And we're particularly proud that LDG has chosen to spend a little time with us here on Ham Nation so that we can tell you about their stuff. It's really, really good stuff. And LDG Electronics provides state-of-the-art automatic antenna tuners for every amateur need, from QRP to QRO, fixed stations, portable, remote. Doesn't matter. They're going to work for you. An LDG tuner will match your radio to your antenna, and they use a lightning-fast proprietary tuning algorithm. If you want a high power, like, say, 1,000 watts on sideband, 500 watts on FM and digital, you got to check out the LDG AT1000 Pro 2. That is the flagship. It tunes from 160 to 6 meters continuously. You can match your Yagi, your dipole, your inverted V, your sloper, virtually any coax-fed antenna from 6 to 1,000 ohms of impedance. Tuning time, under 10 seconds. Memory tuning, under a fifth of a second. That's 0.2 seconds. Has a very large, easy-to-read bar graph watt meter with two selectable ranges, dual antenna switch, 2,000 memories for each position. This is a good little bit of kit. And it comes from a great company, that's owned by a great family. They're owned and operated by the family dedicated to bringing innovative quality products to you in the amateur market. Their focus is on anticipating and meeting your needs and providing you with world-class support that is just a phone call or an email away. And every LDG tuner carries a full 2-year warranty that is fully transferable. So if you ever sell or feeling particularly generous, you give away your LDG tuner, the remainder of the warranty goes with it. Free return shipping on all warranty repairs and all LDG products, including balance and cables, are available for purchase through select resellers. So check out which automatic antenna tuner is right for you. Then go to LDGElectronics.com to learn more. That's LDG Electronics, Lima Delta Golf Electronics.com. And we thank LDG for their support of Ham Nation. Time to head over to the West Coast and check out Gordon Shorts. That didn't sound right.
Well, thank you, Don. And Dwayne Kincaid of LDG sent me a note just saying it's been a wonderful ride with Ham Nation. And he really enjoys us talking about his tuners in real live world of radio. Well, I thought we would do real live world of radio tonight on something that none of us like, and that is noise. So, Victor, if you want to go ahead, and before we talk about noise, Gary called me up going, Gordo, no, not 30 pounds of thrust to raise my about 30-foot pneumatic tower, 20 pounds, and it just goes up slick as a whistle. So, Gary, I got it 20, not 30. And he says that tower is in such great shape that it doesn't even try and mooch down if it doesn't continue to have air pressure, the continuous air pressure that was in it. You can turn off the air pump and it'll stay up for at least a day or so before you got to give it another goose, I think. Well, let's talk about the hazards of power lines. And we'll talk just briefly. It's not the very lower one. That's the cable stuff. It's not the one up from that. That's the telephone stuff. It's not the three up from that'll give you into trouble. That's the 240. But rather, it's the top two. And those are the ones that in wet weather sound just like this. Power line noise. Ugly, wasn't it? Well, that is power line noise. And there's no simple little filter on anyone's radio that's going to cure power line noise. It'll certainly help it, but it's something we all have to put up with. And if you've got power line noise, get a hold of your local power company and tell them to wash those insulators. I was very concerned when our neighbor across the street put on a ton of solar, but I'm happy to report it was a well-known solar company. They well grounded everything that you can see just to the left of the garage door. And I've not have felt that there's been any real noise coming out of his solar installation. Whew, I'm happy about that, believe me. And what I use is a Sea Crane AM radio, one that tunes aeronautical. And those of you with many of today's ham radios that also do the aircraft band, when you go down to below 130, the radio should flop over to AM. That's the way that you're going to look for noise. So if you have any one of little portable radios that tune into the AM broadcast band, then you want to go below or in between strong AM stations and then approach what you think is maybe a neighbor with a clandestine operation of grow lights, of which I found two houses away that radiated about a block away. Anyway, the little radio is directional, as we'll show you shortly, and it works great in identifying noise sources. But first of all, the noise may be coming from your own house. And no, just turning things off won't do it. Sometimes something as innocuous as a tiny wall wart driving a cell phone, some of the inexpensive ones are horribly noisy on HF. So how do you know? Well, hopefully, if you've got power selector, a whole bunch of circuit breakers, you've got them labeled as you see I do here, with whatever that plan is growing to the right. And if I get just the right circuit breaker and the noise disappears, then whoa, then I know it's in the house. And by looking at what circuit's in the house, I can begin to find out where. Well, this one was coming from the garage. And I thought, what in the world would be causing this noise coming from the garage? Yeah, that was ugly. Well, that was the spin cycle, and I could actually tell where the clothes were in their cycle getting washed by monitoring. Not with a little, this is actually the large sea crane radio, not with a big one right there next to the washing machine, but on an HF radio and a four-element beam about 40 feet away. The modern washing machine radiates that kind of noise, and depending whether it's on the broom, broom, broom noise, which might be just washing the clothes, or the spin cycle, which you just heard, that can help you identify where the noise is coming from. The cure is, no, there's no magic washer filter on your radio. The cure is stop the washing machine and just be sure and turn it back on before the XYL finds out that you stopped the machine. The fax machines, those are a steady whistle, and those usually only affect the VHF, UHF bands. And this is actually not only a fax machine, but a telephone router and so on. Many times you hear a steady carrier. Unplug the machine and see if that's what the culprit is of the noise on 2 meters. Now, Roger at Wiredco and Kimmers would say that their LED strips, like you see here, are going to be quiet. And the answer is yes. The strips are quiet because there's no microprocessor that's taking 110 down to 12 volts DC or whatever voltage. These LED strips work right off of 12 volts, and they've got the little tiny resistor to get up the LEDs to the correct brightness. And the one on the top is sort of unique. That Roger of Wiredco sells, and that is it can either shoot up or shoot down, not right in your face like the one on the bottom. So you're not going to have a problem with LED 12-volt strips until you decide to do a dimmer. Now, you could do a dimmer off of a small pot that you would use for volume control in an older radio. Or you could do one of the new microprocessor dimmers that will just tear up HF for about a block. So stay away from those lightweight switcher dimmers because, indeed, they're going to be creating noise. In fact, we wanted to see how much noise that the dimmers created. We put one online here, and bingo, you can see on the station monitor that the noise came way up. But that's because of the dimmer. What about your air conditioning? Well, if you live in an older house, as we do, you'll find that the old mechanical with mercury switch are quiet. But the new microprocessor ones may be noisy. And the way you tell, I go to 10 megahertz, tune in 10, the WWV. And by the way, all this week and all next week, WWV or WW0 WWV is on the air on many of the different bands, as well as the public service announcement from the military defense department on the WWV 10 meg frequency. I use that as a benchmark to see what's radiating the noise. And what we're really getting a lot of noise from are the grow lights, and those predominantly, as we see in the spikes here, are down on high frequency from 2 megahertz all the way to 30 megahertz. Those grow lights that are throughout the country now, especially here in California, they really create a noise that goes about a block, but mainly on high frequency. So now we say, well, the new LED bulbs, they're nice and clean, aren't they? They are on high frequency, just like a regular light bulb. But up on 2 meters and 440, that's a different deal. Well, how do you tell if you've got a noisy LED? Maybe you've screwed in that brand new LED into a lamp circuit, and you're saying, is it going to interfere with 2 meters? Well, doggone it, on 2 meters, signals are up, signals are off. But the 24-hour weather service on 162.400 or 162.500, 162.55, tune into a weak weather station and then listen when you turn the LED on and off. And if you turn it on a weak, not a strong one, but one that's just in the soup, if that noise clouds weather reception, as you'll hear here, when you turn on and off the LED, then you know that's the culprit. So let's take a listen and see what it sounds like.
Tonight, partly cloudy, low of 52 today. Areas of wind southwest, 15 miles.
Did you hear that? It completely clobbered the weather station. It's completely clobbering your 2 meter station and maybe 440 as well. And I thought that you could tell by maybe a brand name, whether they made in China or Taiwan or whatever. Nope, you just got to screw it in and tune into a weak weather station. And on your 2 meter radio, tune to a weak weather station. Sometimes these bulbs will go as far as 30 or 40 feet to cloud reception. So if lately your 2 meter signal received stinks, you might want to see by turning off and on the LEDs whether or not they're the culprit. But wait a minute. When you turn them on, there's about a 3-second lag before the noise builds up. And when you turn them off, the noise disappears immediately. So something to check for on light-emitting diodes, including those that are spot lamps. The LED on the top is just as bright as the old incandescent on the bottom. LED on the top does get a little bit warm. And why is it getting warm? Because the LEDs are down at 12 and 10 volts, whereas you're pumping in 110 volts. And how do you get from 110 down to 10? You got to chop it up. And you know what happens on chopper circuits. But the LEDs are mainly affecting the VHF and UHF band. I've never really heard of a noisy LED down on high frequency. And again, the LED strips are clear. Oh, my gosh. This is the killer. Take a listen. The dimmer switch, we're tuned in to 75 meters. Was that disgusting or what? So if you've got a dimmer switch, even all the way on, the switching circuit is still switching, and that's what is creating the problem. And on HF, you know you've got a switcher problem when you look at your pan adapter and you see spikes every 10 or 20 or 15 or 25 kilohertz, as we see here. And here, oh my God, this has wiped you out. This is not something down the street. This is something in your own home. So if this looks like an accordion on the scope, then you've got to do a little prowling around and see what's creating the noise. Palomar Engineers out of Escondido, California. Palomar does a fine job of many different chokes and filters and so on. And if you get a chance and you really have a noise problem, give Palomar a call and tell them what frequency. Maybe let them listen to the noise, and hopefully they're going to be able to solve your problem. Palomar Engineers. You see them at all the ham fests. And nothing beats a good little AM radio, because that AM radio, is directional, and you can use a simple little AM radio for coming up and finding that device in your house that's getting all the noise. You betcha, noise reduction, noise blanker, automatic noise limiter, they sure help on today's transceivers. but really to lick the noise either on VHF, UHF for satellite work or down on HF for working digital, you don't know you're getting clobbered with noise because most digital operators don't listen with earphones. They just watch the screen. You don't know what's going on. So grab those earphones and put them on and take a listen to the incoming signals. And if you hear this kind of a, you know you got noise. Cut the noise at the source. So, George, over to you without any noise at all. George?
Well, Gordo, I'm kind of disappointed to hear you talking about, well, the display you had there on the spectrum scope that looked like a comb with all those little spikes every few kilohertz apart. When you said that's not coming from down the street, that's coming from your own QTH. So apparently I am quarming myself. That's not good. Yeah, I see it sometimes.
Yeah, George, you got to go out there and switch off all of those circuit breakers so that you're going to lunch all of the presets on stuff that's not battery backed up. But once you do the presets and put them back in, you should be able to, via switches, be able to find out which part of the house is creating the noise. But something that strong on your home antenna, that's coming from right there at your own home, I bet. And the only way to tell, switch all the breakers off and see if the noise goes away while monitoring with a little radio like this. And by the way, C. Crane, really big on the internet, really good people, has a wonderful catalog, and all of you should just go to C.Crane and ask for their catalog. Tell them Gordo sent you, and they have some wonderful shortwave devices. George?
Oh, yeah, they do make great radios. Well, Gordo, thanks for that information there on noise. It's always good to get a little refresher and to hear some samples to give you an idea of where your noise is coming from. So I've got a little more work to do. It's not there all the time. It's only intermittently. So next time I notice it, I'm going to have to go put everybody in the dark here and see if I can figure out where it's coming from. Well, we'll be back in just a moment because we've got a lot more to go tonight. But first, let's get a message from ICOM.
Heard it, worked it, logged it. It's time to get the transceiver that's best suited for your lifestyle. ICOM offers a variety of high-performance and innovative products. Make the most out of contest season with one of these ICOMs today. IC7610, the SDR every ham wants. This high-performance SDR has the ability to pick out the faintest of signals, even in the presence of stronger adjacent signals. The ICOM IC7610 is a direct sampling, software-defined radio that will change the world's definition of a SDR transceiver. RF direct sampling, 110 RMDR, independent dual receivers, and dual digicell. Or get the IC7300. Changing the way entry-level HF is designed, this high-performance, innovative HF transceiver with a compact design will far exceed your expectations. RF direct sampling, 15 discrete bandpass filters, large 4.3-inch color touchscreen, real-time spectrum scope, and SD memory card slot. Keep your competitive edge with faster processors, higher input gain, higher display resolution, and a cleaner signal. ICOM's IC7851 is the pinnacle of HF perfection. Dual receivers, digital IF filters, memory keyer, digital voice recorder, high-resolution spectrum waterfall display, enhanced PC connectivity, and SD memory card slot. Visit ICOMAmerica.com/amateur for more information on all the great ICOM radios.
And ICOM invites you to enter their drawings for weekly prizes, great swag prizes, t-shirts, hats. And when you do that, you'll automatically be entered for the monthly grand prize drawing for a new radio. You go to icomamerica.com/hamnation and register, and you could win, as I mentioned, the swag prizes, but you might want to win that radio as well. And for September, that radio is going to be the ICOM ID5100A dual band dual watch mobile. It's got built-in GPS, it's D-Star analog, touchscreen operation, DVDV dual watch, DVFM repeater list function, a SD memory card slot for voice and data storage, and there's an available U2-133 Bluetooth module, as well as downloadable Bluetooth and Android apps available. So go to icomamerica.com/hamnation after this and each episode and register to win. Sign up, good luck, and don't forget to follow ICOM America Inc. on Facebook and Twitter. And speaking of things ICOM's given away, well, we've got 14th anniversary coming up on Amateur Logic, October 15th. ICOM is ponied up with another great rig this year. It is the ICOM IC7300 that we're all familiar with, a great SDR radio. They say it's entry level, although it's got big rig features on it. It's a great rig. Hey, you might want to win that as well. You can enter by going to contest@amateurlogic.tv. No, that's where you send your email. Go to amateurlogic.tv/contest and register right there. And you could, well, you could actually win that radio, the IC7300, or you could also win the prizes that go with it. Well, it's not or, it all comes together as a package. You're going to need an antenna to go with it. So we've got an MFJ cobweb antenna. This is actually one we use every year at field day. We take out, this one goes from 20 meters on up through 6 meters, but they also have them through 40 meters. It's a great portable antenna. It's always worked well for us, and it's very compact. So a great little antenna as well. You'll need a power supply, so I've got an MFJ. This is the MFJ 1836H. It's a cobweb. It's not a cobweb, obviously. It's a power supply, a mighty light power supply, up to 30 amps of output. It's got your usual banana plugs and binding post on the front, as well as two pair of Anderson power poles on the rear. And this is my personal supply here. I use it anytime I need a supply for a project I'm working on or operating an event like field day or whatever. It's a great little supply, and it's mighty light. Of course, you know, that's a nice rig, and you can get a nice microphone to go with it as well, like this Heil ICM microphone right here. This is the newer model. It's the Heil ICM BG. It's black and gold. Looks great. Sounds great on ICOM rigs, specially designed to work with them. It's got a push-to-talk button on it as well. It comes with the connectors installed just for ICOM rigs right here, specially designed with a little higher output suitable for those ICOM rigs. And, you know, you're going to need coax, so we're going to throw in 100 feet of MFJ RG8X coax. And one other prize here we're going to throw in is the MFJ 148RC. You've probably seen this before. This is a remote-controlled clock. It sets itself to WWV. It's got two time zones on it. I set one of them for Central Time here, my local time. You can display it in 24 or 12-hour format. And I set the other side for UTC. It automatically keeps itself up to date all the time, so I never have to worry about if it's accurate. And there's a built-in 10-minute ID timer on the top there. And, of course, built-in backlight to give you a little extra light. Nice big clock, sets itself, so it's kind of a no-brainer. And, you know, you might not be a general or an extra, and you're going to want that to operate this IC7300. So we're also going to throw in one of Gordo's great books, your choice of the technician guide, the extra guide, or the general guide. courtesy of Gordo and W5YI. And so why wouldn't you want to win that? And you need to go register now because it's going to be given away next month. That's amateurlogic.tv/contest to get all the details. And we thank ICOM, MFJ, Heil Sound, and Gordon West, W5YI, for making that possible. And one extra thing we're going to throw in just to sweeten the pot a little bit is a pair. And this is not them, but Tommy promises me he still has a pair of the Faux Gold PL259 connectors. This is the cheap Amphenol ones here, but you'll get the real fake gold ones if you win this. So, hey, we're celebrating 14 years, and you can celebrate right along with us. Well, now, speaking of celebrating, Randy has got a great video tonight. This is the Early Television Museum, and boy, I really enjoyed it. You're going to want to go watch the whole video because we've only got the first 10 minutes here. But, just see what I mean.
I'm at the Early Television Museum in Hillard, Ohio. And we'll go inside and see what's going on. So I'm inside the Early Television Museum, and let's take a look at the early mechanicals. So here's the sets that are on display in this room. And they have a audio narration that talks us through five of the sets. Pretty interesting collection of mechanical spinning wheel televisions.
The earliest television sets used mechanical means to create a picture.
Find the small green sign with one on it.
The first patent for television was granted in 1884. It described a system using rotating discs with holes drilled in them. One disc was in the camera in front of a photoelectric cell. An identical disc was used in the receiver in front of a neon tube. The picture was viewed through a magnifying lens in front of the disc. At that time, many of the components needed to make the system work didn't exist, such as vacuum tubes. Many years later, in 1926, a Scottish inventor named John Logie Baird produced the first television fixtures in his laboratory in London. 3 years later, he was broadcasting to viewers. The pictures were extremely crude. Today's television pictures are made up of over 1,000 lines, allowing for very clear pictures. Baird's transmissions were with 30 lines. By 1930, there were about 30 stations in the U.S. and stations in most major European cities. Because they used the same channels as AM radio, signals could be received over long distances. This is the TV set that Baird's company sold starting in 1929. About 1,000 were made. The cabinet is metal, and the viewer watched through the lens on the front. You could buy a TV set, or you could build your own, since they were simple devices. A few years ago, we interviewed Murray Mercier. His picture is on the wall, who told us that as a teenager, he helped his father make the first TV set in Columbus. The small set on the table was their first set. In 1928, they watched some of the first U.S. broadcasts from Schenectady, New York, and Washington, D.C. The next year, they built the larger set on the table. Murray's father rented a store on North High Street and put the set in the front window. Murray's job was to sit in the window of the store in the evening and keep the set adjusted so people walking up and down High Street could see television.
So here is a Western Union telegraph dated November 28, 1928, from GE, or General Electric Radio Station, WGY, in Schenectady, New York. It says, received human face turning side to side and moving lips. Also two other objects by our television receiving set.
This is the Western Visionette, an example of an American set that was sold to the public. About 500 of these were made. This is the Western Empire State Receiver. About 1932, a new technology emerged, which allowed the picture to be projected on a screen, allowing more than one person to watch it. However, the picture was very dim and still only had 45 lines in it. Because of the poor picture quality with mechanical television, it was impossible to do real television programming. Because of this, and since the Great Depression limited the number of people who could afford television sets, mechanical TV broadcasting came to an end in 1932.
Some of the tubes used in the early rotating disc televisions.
There are two main components in an electronic television system: the camera tube, which converts an image to an electrical signal, and the picture tube, which converts that signal into a visible picture. By 1930, engineers had developed picture tubes that were suitable for television. On the shelf is a small one from the late 20s. However, a working camera tube still hadn't been developed. Two inventors were responsible for solving the problem. Philo Farnsworth grew up in rural Idaho and had no formal scientific education. He came up with an idea for a camera tube, got some investors, and moved to San Francisco. In 1927, he produced a crude picture from his camera. The problem was that it required too much light, and he never overcame that limitation. The other inventor was Vladimir Zworykin. Zworykin worked for Westinghouse in the 1920s, where he also made a camera tube and demonstrated it in the late 20s. In 1930, he went to work for RCA, the largest radio manufacturer at the time. RCA was run by David Sarnoff, a visionary who realized that television would be the next big thing and who spent about $50 million during the Great Depression to develop TV. Zworykin's camera tube, the iconoscope, worked with a relatively low amount of light and allowed a practical television system to be developed. By 1935, RCA had a working system, but Sarnoff decided not to start selling TV sets because the technology was expensive and unreliable, and because the Great Depression was still going on. The British, however, had a government-run broadcasting entity, the BBC, and decided to launch the first electronic TV in the fall of 1936, primarily using RCA's technology. The sets in this room and in the small room next to it were made from 1936 to 1939. This is the earliest British electronic set we have in our collection. It was made in 1936. Since there was only a single TV station in the country, the sets didn't have a channel selector knob. A modest set cost as much as a new car, so only about 19,000 were made during those 3 years. About 300 of these sets survive. Larger screen sets had mirrors to watch the picture. This was because the picture tubes were about 2.5 feet long, and mounting them vertically made it possible to make a more attractive cabinet. Since television broadcasting was limited to a couple of hours a day, many of the sets had shortwave radios built in. When England declared war on Germany in 1939, television manufacturing and broadcasting ended in England. In 1939, RCA decided that it was time to make television available to the American public. RCA had a large pavilion at the 1939 World's Fair featuring television. There was an area at the fair where people could stand in front of a TV camera and their friends could see them on television. This camera may have been one of those used at the fair. When the fair began, NBC, which was owned by RCA, began regularly scheduled TV programming. RCA introduced their television product line at the fair. The cheapest, which is on the left, required a separate radio for the sound. The most elaborate one, on the right, included a radio and had a 12-inch picture. Many other companies also started selling sets in 1939. Andrea made a 5-inch set with a magnifying lens to make the picture appear larger. Next to it is a kit set, which took dozens of hours to assemble. You could save a few dollars by doing it yourself. General Electric made 5 different models of TV sets in 1939 and 1940. About 7,000 sets were made in the United States during 1939 and 1940, and about 350 survive today. As with the British pre-war sets, a mid-range set cost as much as a new car. When the United States entered World War II in 1941, production of TV sets stopped, though many stations continued to broadcast with experimental programming throughout the war. During the war, RCA engineers worked on military projects, including a television-guided bomb. This camera was put inside a wooden glider that was taken up underneath a B-17 bomber. It was released when it was close to a target, and television was used to guide the bomb.
During the war, engineers learned a lot about technology, especially from radar and aircraft communication that could be applied to television. As a result, the sets made right after the war were much simpler, more reliable, and cheaper. A typical 10 or 12-inch set cost about $400 compared to about $1,600 for a car. These sets are from right after the war. As you can see, manufacturers were experimenting with all sorts of cabinet designs to find out what would sell. There were dozens of companies making sets. In 1948, the 7-inch set was introduced, some with built-in magnifiers. This might seem like a step backward, but it allowed sets to be sold for under $200. Because the cost of a television set kept dropping, television grew very rapidly. At the end of 1947, there were only 200,000 sets in the United States. By the end of 1953, 6 years later, there were 18 million, and half the homes in the country had TV.
Wow. That is really interesting. You know, who would have ever thought we'd have pictures on the radio? Well, apparently, Sarnoff did, and the folks in Britain. Very interesting stuff. You're going to want to watch the rest of that. So go to K7AGE's YouTube channel. Just search for K7AGE on YouTube. You'll find it. And watch this video. He's got about another 15 minutes it just goes through the rest of the tour. Yeah, some really interesting things there. I know all of us who's worked around television really appreciate that, but probably you do too, because groundbreaking technology at the time and just keeps changing. Although the early days when we were using vacuum tubes and all, that was really a challenge, I've got to say, and those folks pulled it off. So thanks for that, Randy. And by the way, Randy wants to know what you've been building. Send pictures, no videos, please, and a description of what you've been building to hamprojects@twit.tv, and Randy will include you in an upcoming episode of Show Us Your Projects, and let the world know what it is you've been building. Send them to Randy, hamprojects@twit.tv, and we look forward to seeing what you've got going on. Well, now it is time to find out, well, from Don, what is new at DX Engineering and what's going on in the news. Don?
Yeah, a couple of very exciting subjects for sure. Let's talk about what's going on at DX Engineering first off. You know, the antenna, your radio, you could have a $1 million station, but if you don't have an antenna, what are you going to do, right? There's no better way to take the guesswork out of testing, tuning, and repairing your antennas and keeping them in tip-top shape and your feed lines, too, than with a quality antenna analyzer. And DX Engineering has analyzers from world leader Rig Expert, including the family of Zoom analyzers. The AA35 Zoom covers from 60 kilohertz through 35 megahertz. The AA55 Zoom covers from 60 kilohertz through 55 megahertz. And the AA230 Zoom covers from 100 kilohertz through 230 megahertz. Here's some of the ways that you can take full advantage of these invaluable tools for your station. The Zoom analyzers, well, they're ideal for checking coax cable assemblies, measuring antennas, stats such as SWR, impedance, return loss, the capacitance or inductance of reactive load. You can use them for tuning your antenna to resonance, SWR and impedance comparison before and after a specific event, such as rain or icing up in the winter, fault location, and a whole lot more. They feature simple interfaces and self-explanatory menus with ham-friendly keyboard markings. And their unique zoom-in function, that's how they got their name, the zoom-in function allows you to view graphic points up close on a 3.2-inch color display. And the analyzers give you measurements for 25, 50, 75 and 100 ohm systems. Other features include waterproof keypads, multilingual menus, and a USB link to a PC so you can save your scans so you can do future comparisons. The 55 zoom and 230 zoom models are also now available with a Bluetooth option. The integrated Bluetooth wireless technology lets you work in conjunction with a smartphone, tablet, or a laptop. You can operate the analyzer remotely, see the characteristics of your antenna in more detail, and share measurement results on social networks. DX Engineering offers packages that let you purchase both a rig expert analyzer and a sturdy case to keep it safe. Custom-designed Nanook equipment cases are available for all three Zoom models and other rig expert analyzers, and each case is filled with cubed, sectioned foam so you can create the ideal padded space for your analyzer for a perfect fit. You really need to check out those Nanooks. Those things are killer cases. And DX Engineering ships faster than anybody else in the industry. Most orders placed by 10 p.m. Eastern are shipped the same day. Proven products, expert advice, DX Engineering helps you shrink the globe. Request your catalog or shop online 24/7 at dxengineering.com/hamnation. That is DX Engineering, and we certainly thank them for their support of Ham Nation. We've got the solar report from Dr. T coming up right after this from Amateur Radio Newsline. From Amateur Radio Newsline Report, number 2185, these are the Ham Nation headlines for Wednesday, September 18th, 2019. Our top story this week is a tale of personal triumph. You may remember Newsline's interview last autumn with the YL sailing around the world hoping to set a new record. Well, she did it.
Jan Socrates, VE0JS, sailed jubilantly into Victoria, British Columbia past the Ogden Point breakwater on Saturday, September 7th, ending her 339-day journey and beginning her new status as record holder. Jan, who is 77, has become the oldest person to sail solo around the world non-stop and unassisted. During the journey that began October 3rd, 2018, the retired university mathematics professor made hundreds of QSOs on HF and blogged about her daily challenges and activities. In November of last year, she spoke to Newsline from her vessel when it was north of Dulce Island and en route to New Zealand and Australia by way of Cape Horn. Sea swells, two cyclones, and equipment malfunctions were formidable but temporary obstacles, and she savored her 4 months later than planned arrival home, all the more because of them. For Amateur Radio Newsline, I'm John Williams, VK4JJW.
India's space agency has located the lander from its failed lunar mission.
India's crashed Vikram lunar lander, part of the nation's failed Chandrayaan-2 mission, was located on the lunar surface, according to reports from the Indian Space and Research Organisation, or ISRO. ISRO reported that it was attempting to make contact with the lander, which had been photographed via thermal image from the orbiter. The mission had entered lunar orbit on August 20th and its lander separated on September 2nd to prep for its eventual descent. The goal was to make a soft landing and deploy a robotic lunar rover to search for water near the south pole of the moon. The mission was considered the agency's most complex to date. Officials said the orbiter will continue to study the moon from a distance. A successful landing would have made India the fourth nation to achieve a lunar landing after the United States, the former Soviet Union, and China. India has said it hopes to send a trio of astronauts into space by 2022. For Amateur Radio Newsline, I'm Jason Daniels, VK2LAW.
Here's some good news for Hamvention fans who've begun to settle in each May at the Greene County Fairgrounds.
Dayton Hamvention isn't likely to be going anywhere anytime soon. The Dayton Daily News reports that Greene County, Ohio's Fair Board has reached an agreement with organizers to keep the massive amateur radio gathering at the Greene County Fairgrounds and Exposition Center in Xenia for the next 5 years. The announcement comes on the heels of word that Hamvention drew 32,472 attendees earlier this spring, a total considered the highest since the event relocated from its longtime home at Hera Arena. The first Hamvention at the Greene County Fairgrounds was held in 2017. Ron Kramer, KD8ENJ, president of the Dayton Amateur Radio Association, has said in the past that the event's annual economic impact on the region is between $15 and $18 million. Kathleen Wright, executive director of the Greene County Convention and Visitors Bureau, told the Dayton Daily News that with continued growth expected for Hamvention and more hotel rooms becoming available, even more attendees can be accommodated in the years ahead. For Amateur Radio Newsline, I'm Jack Parker, W8ISH.
And that's all from the Amateur Radio Newsline, your independent source for amateur radio news for four decades and counting at arnewsline.org. With John Williams, VK4JJW, Jason Daniels, VK2LAW, Jack Parker, W8ISH, Karen Eve Murray, KD2GUT at the news desk in New York, and our news team across the globe. I'm Don Wilbanks, AE5DW. 7-3. We'll see you next time here on Ham Nation. Now, here's the solar update with Dr. Tamitha Scove, WX6SWW.
The sun gives us a mixed bag of space weather with pockets of fast wind and some stealthy solar storms. Those stories and more in the news this week. This forecast, sponsored in part by Eric Johansson. Check him out at Instagram.com/scubist. Space weather this week is definitely a bit of a mixed bag. We've been bumped to unsettled and active conditions kind of up and down throughout the week. As we switch to our front side sun, you can see why. We have a coronal hole that's down in the southern polar region. That has been giving us some sporadic fast solar wind. And along with a couple like mini solar storms that have been firing and have been near misses to Earth, it's definitely been bumping us up to active conditions and keeping things really unsettled. As a matter of fact, on the 16th, we got yet another solar storm that was launched. This is a stealthy solar storm kind of in the northern hemisphere. It launched a solar storm that's earthward directed, and so that could give us yet some more activity around the 19th and 20th that could bump us back up to unsettled conditions. So expect this to continue. We also have, as of next week, we're going to have another small coronal hole rotating into Earth or into Earth's strike zone, and that could give us yet some more unsettled conditions from some more fast solar wind. As we switch to our backside sun, you can see that first coronal hole, there's actually two of them. That first one is the one that's rotating into Earth view now, and that's the one that could bug us next week. But if you look behind it in stereo's view, this is stereo looking at the sun from the side, you can definitely see that larger coronal hole. Now that coronal hole, that's the one that gave us a G2 level storm about 2 weeks ago, and it looks like it has survived its backside passage, and it will be rotating into the Earth strike zone in about 2 weeks, and it could give us yet another G2 level solar storm. Switching to our moon, we are now passing through the third quarter phase on our way to a new moon, and by the 25th, the moon will only be about 20% illuminated. So you night sky watchers, now's a good chance to start looking for those dim objects in the sky. Switching to your solar storm conditions and aurora possibilities over the coming week, we're going to continue to expect a bit of a mixed bag this week. We could be bumped up to unsettled and even active conditions, partly from the pockets of fast solar wind that the sun keeps sending us, along with the mini stealthy solar storms that the sun keeps launching. There's that one that was launched on the 16th that is Earth-directed. So right around the 20th and the 21st, at high latitudes, we could be seeing up to active conditions, most likely unsettled, but up to active conditions with about a 20 to 25% chance of a minor storm. Now, at mid-latitudes, we're expecting normal conditions to unsettled conditions, but we could see up to about a 15 to 20% chance of active conditions over a short period while this storm hits us and kind of blows over. It's kind of hard to tell, so you aurora photographers, only if you're really dedicated should you worry about chasing this particular storm, because aurora shows could be very, very fleeting. But this does mean we will most likely continue to see unsettled and kind of this mixed bag of conditions easily over the rest of this week. Switching to your solar flare and particle radiation storm outlook over the coming week, everything is still in the green when it comes to solar flares. We have a spotless sun both on the front side and on the back side of the sun right now, so we have no risk for radio blackouts or anything like that. So you GPS users, you should be very happy. You should be getting great reception on Earth's day side. Now, of course, amateur radio operators and emergency responders, this also means that the solar flux continues to be in the mid to high 60s, which means radio propagation on Earth's day side is poor. The only thing that you have going for you is that we've got these solar storms and this kind of unsettled conditions, which means propagation gets a little bit of a boost from kind of this unsettled solar wind that we've got right now. So enjoy that. If you're getting a little bit of sporadic propagation, it's more likely due to that than anything else. And also you GPS users, well, you know, because of this unsettled conditions, it should make a low latitude GPS reception looking pretty good, but you could have some glitches near the dawn dust terminators. And because we're also at solar minimum, we have the cosmic ray flux being a bit higher than it normally would be. So you frequent flyers, and this does include the air crew who fly over 800 hours annually and fly at high altitudes and high latitudes. You guys are in the moderate range for radiation dose, and this does include prenatal passengers. So please take this into consideration in your flight plans. So the space weather this week is definitely a bit of a mixed bag, and it's going to continue to stay that way. We've been bumping between unsettled conditions to even active conditions due to some pockets of fast solar wind and even some mini stealthy solar storms have been hitting us here and there. And these conditions will continue. So your aurora photographers, you might, especially at high latitudes, you might get your cameras ready around the 20th and the 21st because you could be in for a little bit of an aurora show when yet another stealthy solar storm hits Earth. Now, amateur radio operators and emergency responders, well, we do have a spotless sun right now, and even the backside of the sun is spotless. So that means we've got solar flux kind of sitting in the mid to high 60s, which is poor radio propagation. The one nice thing, however, is that with all this unsettled conditions with the solar wind, that does help boost propagation. So you might get some fun on 6 meters in the magic band, or even with gray line propagation, you might get a few surprises here in there. So kind of stick with it. Now, as far as your GPS users are concerned, well, your dayside reception should look pretty good. There shouldn't be any issues there. You should even get some decent low latitude reception over the course of this next week or so. But you will need to stay away from the dawn dust terminators for the reception during and especially during the stealthy solar storm around the 20th and 21st, because then you could actually get a little bit of glitches in your reception. Outside of that, things should look pretty good. I'm Tamitha Scove. Thank you for watching.
Thank you, Dr. T. Another great report tonight. Make sure you follow her on Twitter. She's a great follow, at Tamitha Scove. Also, she has a bunch of stuff on her YouTube channel, Tamitha Scove, and right there, spaceweatherwoman.com, another great resource. So make sure you check all of those out, because she's constantly putting new stuff on there, and it's just great stuff. All right, let's head over to the chat room with Amanda and see what they're talking about in the chat room.
Well, here's what I'm talking about. If we don't have dawn dusk terminators trending on Twitter soon, we have failed as a ham community. That's all I'm saying. Yep. Way to go, Dr. T. That was awesome. All right. We love RFI stories here on Ham Nation. And thank you, Gordo, for bringing up everything you did tonight. I caught a few of them out of the chat room. Dennis, in X0IA, he says, my daughter's had two Furbies. Does everybody remember Furbies? Those big old eyes, creepy gremlin looking things. And they even like the government had outlawed them, said they couldn't come into their government facilities because they recorded. He said he shut them off and put them in a box. A month later, he heard strange noises coming from his little girl's closet, and it was them having conversations with each other. Now, whether that was RFI caused from inside the house or they were possessed or whatever, still, I said, burn them to the ground. Yeah. Burke said, burn them and then put them through the chipper.
Think how worried we were about Furbies, and now we've got Alexa and Hey Google out there. So, you know, seems like Furbies were kind of the least of our problems, huh?
I do believe so. Now we're asking for it, asking them to listen to all of our conversations. That's interesting. I haven't heard any RF stories from that, except for that only through our own voices, she all of a sudden wakes up when we're talking and I'm like, no one talked to you. Stop talking to us. That's creepy too. All right. The other one that I had in the chat room was when I key my HT on 70 centimeters, my LED light on his desk goes out. That's pretty interesting too. One of my friends, he carries around a Bofang. What's up, Ron? Bofang. This is the whole problem right there. He goes by his weather station and it wipes out all the information. So then he loses his high and low for the day and all of that stuff. So real quick, around the horn there, best RF story. Don, you first.
Wow. I don't really have too much RFI stuff. I do remember, however, though, back when I was a teenager fooling with CB radio, we would put these little NE2 neon lamps up on top of the whip, the antenna on the trunk of the car, and you key up the radio, and the little neon light bulb would come on. I also remember getting the snot burned out of my little finger on an antenna, and somebody keyed up a 150-watt amplifier. It was that was a lot of fun. Yeah.
Bob, what about you? It wasn't fun.
I don't have anything that I can really report. It's all pretty clean here in this house. I'm really fortunate about that, though. But you really have to watch it for some, especially wall warts. Those things are terrible. But yeah. I'm lucky about that. But things are, I guess, pretty good shape when they built this house.
Well, very good. George, any kind of weird RFI issues? I'm sure you have them at your antenna sites all the time.
Yeah, I have actually used one of the MFJ dishes that is ultrasonic, and just looked around the shack here before and found something was just making a lot of racket, and it ended up being a little wall wart, a little switching supply. But I have some noise around the, well, on and off here, I hear it on HF, and I don't know where it's coming from yet. I'm still trying to track that down. But RFI, yeah, I've got stories there. I've seen radio stations where just a 1 kilowatt AM. Now, you can walk outside near the chain link fence, the gate that's closed there, and hear music coming out of the gate. I've seen fluorescent lights in the ceiling that you turn off the switch and the lights are still on. Now, not as bright, but on a little bit. You know, and there's all kinds of stuff like that happening around high RF fields. But as far as, you know, QRM type of stuff, I've got, you know, on ham radio. Yeah, I've seen a lot of stuff, particularly in mobile. And I've got a problem I need to track down right now with some birdies on certain frequencies on my HF rig. Mm-hmm. But I've had real bad alternator whine before and had to build a filter for that. I've had problems with spark plug noise. As a matter of fact, I've got some kind of ignition noise problem right now. Fortunately, the noise blanker on my IC7000 will almost completely eliminate it. If I did not have the noise blanker, it would just be totally unusable. So I need to find the source. Like Gordo says, that is the best way to solve your interference problems, is do it at the source. You know, if the the RF interference never gets in your receiver, that's the best way to eliminate it.
You know, speaking of fluorescent lights, I can remember working at KOMA in Oklahoma City, a 50,000-watt radio station, and when they would sign the radio station off, like late at night on Sunday night, Monday morning, to do transmitter maintenance, they would leave just the dead carrier on, 50,000 watts at 15:20 a.m., and the engineer and I would walk out about 100 yards out to where the tower arrays were. We had three towers out in the backyard, and we would carry a couple of six-foot-long fluorescent tubes, and we'd get about halfway out there, they'd blink on. We just hang them in the chain link fence and work by the light of the RF. And I can remember going into the doghouse, the tuning shack, and feeling the hairs on my arm vibrate just from being so close to that 50,000 watt feed point. Is just really freaky. RF is freaky stuff.
That is freaky.
And before a certain date, that was okay. It was legal to work like that, and then they changed the laws, and now.
Not now.
You can't go around that. You know, not for, well, it's time exposure.
Yeah.
Interesting. Well, so you guys, if you walk into your shack and your hairs are on, you know, that's not okay now. Oh, yeah, we've had some really crazy RF stuff, but we lived in some really horrible places that were really old and really bad wiring. So keying up on 80 meters with 200 watts would set off our alarm system. Being too close to Jeff running a traffic net, and my keyboard would no longer work on my laptop or the keypad. Same thing with my old smartphones. And I'm talking about in like 2008 or so, they would just lock up. You couldn't do any swiping anymore or anything like that. So RF does some really weird stuff. And it's really hard to hunt down, and it's usually clean electricity as far as my opinion is. So, all right, let's move on because we could talk about this all night long. There's so many stories to tell about it. I did have a legit question here. Not that everyone's stories weren't legit. Adam, 80 AM, he has a big question about whether he should choose an ID 51 or an ID 31 to use with a hotspot because he has no D-Star repeaters around him or anything. And I'm just going to go off of my own opinion first, and then I'll send it out there. I like that ID 51 because you can choose colors. So also, and I don't know much about the 31, but I like the 51 because you can still put in frequencies and change from the front end, front face of it. Don, what do you think?
The major difference is the 31 is UHF only and the 51 is dual band. So, you know, if you've got, like, I've got a hotspot here that is only 2 meters. I've got one of the original DVAPs, the DVAP dongle, and it is a 2 meter dongle. So most of the other ones are now UHF, but that's kind of your choice whether you have a VHF dongle. Obviously, you want a VHF radio, VHF hotspot, VHF radio, UHF hotspot, UHF radio. Now, you know, you get the 51. You've got a full-featured dual-band radio with D-Star, so that seems like the best bang for the buck right there. I love my 51.
I do, too. Yeah. I use it to check in on the Wednesday night nets after the show here, and I agree. George, any input?
You know, I can't argue with the ID-51A or any of the ID-51 models. That's what I've got and I've had for years, and super nice handy-talkie. And, you know, it's got a broadcast receiver built into it as well. It's not using the VHF or UHF receiver for that. There is a separate broadcast receiver built into it. So, you know, I've carried the thing around back when I used to go to the walking trails and listen to the radio on it. And if somebody came on the repeater, well, you know, it'd come on through. But a lot of good features on it, of course, D-Star and analog. And the SD, micro SD card slot in it is one of the things I really like because you can do your programming for your radio on the computer with the program, dump it to that little card, and then just stick it into the radio and read it out. You don't have to sit here and do like this trying to program the radio. It's hard to beat.
All good questions or comments about it. And also, he did qualify that he doesn't need 2 meters, but 2 meters is always an option, and you might need it further down the road, or you might be out of town, and you might need to get onto something. I'm just saying, if you can tie the two into one, just get a dual bander. Yeah. That's my personal opinion. All right. Let's go over some nets. We have a major net announcement tonight. Huge, huge, I say. The 20-meter net is moving to 75 meters, and they're going to give that a shot tonight. So Steve, W7UDI, is going to be on around 3905. That's the last spot I saw for them. So everyone, change your antennas, get on the radios, and join him out there. And also we'll have the 40-meter net on 7192. Typically, it could go up or down. D-Star, 14 Charlie, and DMR on 310112. So with that, who's wrapping up the show tonight?
I will. I have a couple of things I need to tell you. First of all, this weekend is the Fall Classic Radio Exchange. There'll be a lot of vintage radios on, both sideband and AM. I think Victor has the frequencies. There they are, right there. Not to say that you have to be right on that, but they'll center around those. And it's really fun because you hear some things that are 50, 60 years old, and you hear 7300. So have a lot of fun. And this is a great, great weekend net. It's on Sunday, 22nd. And again,
It's on Tuesday, the 24th, so and to the 25th. So check that out and join us. We have a lot of fun on those. And the other thing I want to tell you, that I won't be here next week because I'll be in Milwaukee at the Superfest. So anybody going to the Superfest Hamfest, I'll be there. And we'll look forward to seeing the Ham Nation viewers in Milwaukee. So thanks a lot for all tonight. It's been a lot of great, a lot of good information. And well, I'll talk to you in 2 weeks, but everybody else will be back here, right here on the same frequency, the same channel, and all that stuff. This is Bob Heil, K9EID, and we thank you for watching this program about amateur radio. Bye-bye for now.
And see you in Peoria this weekend.